Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. During the last show, we finished with how German theorists apparently had studied the earlier American greenback movement. Zarlinga traces the idea that the state should create its own money to German theorists who had studied our greenback movement. Where Hitler had diverged from the American greenbackers was in equating the financiers who had enslaved the population with the ethnic race of the prominent bankers of the day. The result was to encourage a wave of anti-Semitism that darkened Germany and blackened its leader's name. The 19th century greenbackers saw more clearly what the true enemy was, not an ethnic group, but a financial scheme, one that transferred the power to create money from the collective body of the people to the private banking elite. The terrible human rights violations Germany fell into could have been avoided by a stricter adherence to the American system, keeping the reins of power with the people themselves. While Hitler clearly deserved the opprobrium heaped on him for his later military and racial aggressions, he was enormously popular with the German people, at least for a time. Zarlinga suggests that this was because he temporarily rescued Germany from English economic theory, the theory that money must be borrowed against the gold reserves of a private banking cartel rather than issued outright by the government, which ultimately is the theme of the Web of Debt concept. for the government to have control of direct money production and not use something like the Federal Reserve, which is a private bank. Of course, the reasons for war are complex, but Zarlenga postulates one that is not found in the history books. He says, quote, "Perhaps Germany was expected to borrow gold internationally, and that would have meant external control over her domestic policies. Her decision to use alternatives to gold would mean that the international financiers would be unable to exercise this control through the international gold standard, and this may have led to controlling Germany through warfare instead." End quote. Dr. Henry Macau, a Canadian researcher, adds some evidence for this theory. He quotes from the 1938 interrogation of C.G. Rakovsky, one of the founders of Soviet Bolshevism and a Trotsky intimate, who was tried in show trials in the USSR under Stalin. Rakovsky maintained that Hitler had actually been funded by the international bankers through their agent Hjalmar Schacht. The goal was to control Stalin, who had usurped power from Trotsky. But Hitler had become an even bigger threat than Stalin when he took the bold step of creating his own money. Rakovsky said, quote, "Hitler took over for himself the privilege of manufacturing money, and not only physical monies, but also financial ones. He took over the untouched machinery of falsification and put it to work for the benefit of the state. Are you capable of imagining what would have come if he had infected a number of other states and brought about the creation of a period of autarky? If you can, then imagine its counter-revolutionary functions." End quote. Autarky is a national economic policy that aims at achieving self-sufficiency and eliminating the need for imports. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill reportedly wrote to Lord Robert Boothby, quote, "Germany's unforgivable crime before the Second World War was her attempt to extricate her economic power from the world's trading system and to create her own exchange mechanism which would deny world finance its opportunity to profit." End quote. In his Military History of the Western World, British historian J.F.C. Fuller wrote, quote, "Hitler held that as long as the international money system was based on gold, a nation which cornered gold could impose its will on those who lacked it. This could be done by drying up their sources of exchange and thereby compelling them to accept loans on interest. He decided, one, to refuse foreign interest-bearing loans and base German currency on production instead of on gold. Two, to obtain imports by barter. Three, to put a stop to what was called freedom of the exchanges, that is, license to gamble in currencies and shift private fortunes from one country to another according to the political situation. And four, to create money when men and material were available for work instead of running into debt by borrowing it." Because the life of international finance depended upon the issue of interest-bearing loans to nations in economic distress, Hitler's economics spelt his ruination. In 1936, Winston Churchill is reported to have said to General Robert E. Wood of America, "Germany is getting too strong and we must smash her." End quote. By 1938, Germany's resources were being diverted to war and totalitarian control. The strength of its economy, however, was a pre-war phenomenon. Economist Henry C.K. Liu observes, quote, "The Nazis came to power in Germany in 1933 at a time when its economy was in total collapse, with ruinous war reparation obligations and zero prospects for foreign investment or credit. Yet through an independent monetary policy of sovereign credit and a full employment public works program, the Third Reich was able to turn a bankrupt Germany, stripped of overseas colonies it could exploit, into the strongest economy in Europe within 4 years, even before armament spending began." End of quote. If you are just tuning in, This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In a book called Billions for Bankers, Debts for the People, 1984 publication, Sheldon Emery also credited Germany's phoenix-like rise from the ashes to its decision to issue its own money. He wrote, quote, Germany financed its entire government and war operation from 1935 to 1945 without gold and without debt, and it took the whole capitalist and communist world to destroy the German power over Europe and bring Europe back under the heel of the bankers. Such history of money does not even appear in the textbooks of public, that is, government schools today. End quote. What does appear in modern textbooks is the disastrous runaway inflation suffered in 1923 by the Weimar Republic, the common name for the republic that governed Germany from 1919 to 1933. The radical devaluation of the German mark is cited as the textbook example of what can go wrong when governments are given the unfettered power to print money. That is what it is cited for, but again, in the complex world of economics, things are not always what they seem. So we take a look at hyperinflation. The Weimar financial crisis began with the crushing reparations payments imposed at the Treaty of Versailles. Hjalmar Schacht, who was then the currency commissioner for the Republic, complained, quote, The Treaty of Versailles is a model of ingenious measures for the economic destruction of Germany. The Reich could not find any way of holding its head above the water other than by the inflationary expedient of printing banknotes. End quote. Michael Hudson is an economist who has studied hyperinflation extensively. He asserts that every hyperinflation in history stems from the foreign exchange markets. It stems from governments trying to throw enough of their currency on the market to pay their foreign debts. That was the precipitating cause of the Weimar financial collapse, but there was more. Zerlinga writes that Schacht proceeded in his 1967 book, The Magic of Money, to let the cat out of the bag, writing in German, with some truly remarkable admissions that shatter the accepted wisdom the financial community had promulgated on the German hyperinflation. Schacht said that it was chiefly the privately owned Reichsbank that was pumping new currency into the economy. Like the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Reichsbank was overseen by appointed government officials but was operated for private gain. The mark's dramatic devaluation began soon after the Reichsbank was privatized or delivered to private investors. What drove the wartime inflation into hyperinflation, said Schacht, was speculation against the mark, betting on its decreasing value. He wrote, such speculation had been carried out either with loans which the Reichsbank granted lavishly or with emergency money which one printed oneself and then exchanged for Reichsmarks. Zerlinga wrote, quote, Schacht is telling us that the excessive speculation against the mark, the short selling of the mark, was financed by lavish loans from the private Reichsbank. The margin requirements that the anti-mark speculators needed, and without which they could not have attacked the mark, was provided by the private Reichsbank. End quote. Schacht said he got the disaster under control by putting the Reichsbank under strict regulation and by taking prompt corrective measures to eliminate speculation by eliminating easy access to loans. Hitler then got the country back on his feet with his government-issued MEFO bills. Schacht actually disapproved of this Fedder money, and he wound up getting fired as head of the Reichsbank when he refused to issue it, something that may have saved him at the Nuremberg trials. But he acknowledged in his later memoirs that Fedder's theories had worked. Allowing the government to issue money it needed had not produced the price inflation predicted by classical economic theory. So I'm going to say that again. It's a really important point. Allowing the government to issue the money it needed had not produce the price inflation predicted by classical economic theory. Schacht surmised that this was because factories were sitting idle and people were unemployed. In this, he agreed with Keynes. When the resources were available to increase productivity, adding money to the economy did not increase prices. It increased goods and services. Supply and demand increased together, leaving prices unaffected. These revelations put the notorious hyperinflation of modern history in a different light, and we'll look at that next. In his book, Economic Consequences of the Peace, written in 1919, John Maynard Keynes wrote, "There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and it does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose." End of the quote. The rampant runaway inflations of third world economies are widely blamed on desperate governments trying to solve their economic problems by running the currency printing presses, but closer examinations generally reveals other hands to be at work. What causes merchants to raise their prices is not a sudden flood of money from customers competing for their products, because the money supply has been pumped up with new currency. Rather, it is a dramatic increase in the merchant's own costs as a result of radical devaluation of the local currency. And this devaluation can usually be traced to manipulations in the currency's floating exchange rates. And so I'll give a few examples which are quite notable. One prominent example was Russia. The usual explanation for the drastic runaway inflation that afflicted Russia and its former satellites following the fall of the Iron Curtain is that their governments resorted to printing their own money, that is, diluting the money supply and driving up prices. But as William Engdahl shows in A Century of War, this was not what was actually going on. Hyperinflation was a direct and immediate result of letting their currencies float in foreign exchange markets. He writes, quote, "In 1992, the IMF demanded a free float of the Russian ruble as part of its market-oriented reform. The ruble float led within a year to an increase in consumer prices of 9,900%. And a collapse in real wages of 84%. For the first time since 1917, at least during peacetime, the majority of Russians were plunged into existential poverty. Instead of the hoped-for American-style prosperity, two cars in every garage capitalism, ordinary Russians were driven into economic misery." And that's the end of the quote. After the Berlin Wall came down, the IMF was put in charge of the market reforms that were supposed to bring the former Soviet countries in line with the Western capitalist economies that were dominated by the dollars of the private Federal Reserve and private U.S. banks. The Soviet people acquiesced, lulled by dreams of the sort of prosperity they had seen in the American movies. But Engdahl says it was all a deception. Quote, "The aim of Washington's IMF market reforms in the former Soviet Union was brutally simple. Destroy the economic ties that bound Moscow to each part of the Soviet Union. IMF shock therapy was intended to create weak, unstable economies on the periphery of Russia, dependent on Western capital and on dollar inflows for their survival, a form of neocolonialism. The Russians were to get the standard third world treatment. IMF conditionalities and a plunge into poverty for the population. A tiny elite were allowed to become fabulously rich in dollar terms and manipulable by Wall Street bankers and investors." End quote. It was an intentional continuation of the Cold War by other means, entrapping the economic enemy with loans of accounting entry money. Interest rates would then be raised to unpayable levels, and the IMF would be in charge of the reforms that would open the economy to foreign exploitation in exchange for debt relief. Engdahl writes, quote, "The West, above all the United States, clearly wanted a deindustrialized Russia to permanently break up the economic structure of the old Soviet Union. A major area of the global economy, which had been largely closed to the dollar domain for more than seven decades, was to be brought under its control. The new oligarchs were dollar oligarchs." End quote. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So the Soviet Union was one example of the inflation humbug. Another example was the collapse of Yugoslavia and the Ukraine. Compared to Russia, things were even worse in Yugoslavia, which suffered what has been called the worst hyperinflation in history in 1993 and 1994. The textbook explanation, once again, is that the government was madly printing money. As one college economics professor put it, quote, "After Tito, the Yugoslavian communist leader until 1980, the Communist Party pursued progressively more irrational economic policies. These policies and the breakup of Yugoslavia led to heavier reliance upon printing or otherwise creating money to finance the operation of the government and the socialist economy. This created the hyperinflation," end quote. Well, that was the conventional view, but Engdahl maintains that the reverse was actually true. The Yugoslav collapse occurred because the IMF prevented the government from obtaining the credit it needed from its own central bank. Without the ability to create money and issue credit, the government was unable to finance social programs and hold its provinces together as one nation. The country's real problem was not that its economy was too weak, but that it was too strong. Its mixed model, combining capitalism and socialism, was so successful that it threatened the bankers' IMF shock therapy model. Engdahl states, quote, "For over 40 years, Washington had quietly supported Yugoslavia and the Tito model of mixed socialism as a buffer against the Soviet Union. As Moscow's empire began to fall apart, Washington had no more use for a buffer, especially a nationalist buffer, which was economically successful, one that might convince neighboring states in Western Europe that a middle way other than the IMF shock therapy was possible. The Yugoslav model had to be dismantled for this reason alone in the eyes of top Washington strategists. The fact that Yugoslavia also lay on a critical path to the potential oil riches of Central Asia merely added to the argument." End of quote. So Yugoslavia was another victim of what we talked about in the past, the tequila trap, the lure of wealth and development if it would open its economy to foreign investment and foreign loans. According to a 1984 Radio Free Europe report, Tito had made the mistake of allowing the country the luxury of importing more goods than it exported and of borrowing huge sums of money abroad to construct hundreds of factories that never made a profit. When the dollars were not available to pay back these loans, Yugoslavia had to turn to the IMF for debt relief. The jaws of the whale then opened, and Yugoslavia disappeared within. As a condition of debt relief, the IMF demanded wholesale privatization of the country's state enterprises. The result was to bankrupt more than 1,100 companies and produce more than 20% unemployment. IMF policies caused inflation to rise dramatically, until by 1991, it was over 150%. When the government was not able to create the money it needed to hold its provinces together, economic chaos followed, causing each region to fight for its own survival. Engdahl states, quote, reacting to this combination of IMF shock therapy and direct Washington destabilization, the Yugoslav president, Serb nationalist Slobodan Milosevic, organized a new communist party in November 1990, dedicated to preventing the breakup of the Federated Yugoslav Republic. The stage was set for a gruesome series of regional ethnic wars, which would last a decade and result in the deaths of more than 200,000 people. In 1992, Washington imposed a total economic embargo on Yugoslavia, freezing all trade and plunging the economy into chaos, with hyperinflation and 70% unemployment as the result. The Western public, above all in the United States, was told by establishment media that the problems were all the result of a corrupt Belgrade dictatorship. End quote. Similar interventions precipitated runaway inflation in the Ukraine, where the IMF reforms began with an order to end state foreign exchange controls in 1994. The result was an immediate collapse of the currency. The price of bread shot up 300%, electricity shot up 600%, public transportation shot up 900%. State industries that were unable to get bank credit were forced into bankruptcy. As a result, says Engdahl, quote, foreign speculators were free to pick the jewels among the rubble at dirt cheap prices. The result was that the Ukraine, once the breadbasket of Europe, was forced to beg food aid from the U.S., which dumped its grain surpluses on Ukraine, further destroying local food self-sufficiency. Russia and the states of the former Soviet Union were being treated like the Congo or Nigeria as sources of cheap raw materials, perhaps the largest sources in the world. Those mineral riches were now within the reach of Western multinationals for the first time since 1917. End quote. And then we can go over to South America because, meanwhile, the same debt monster that swallowed the former Soviet economies was busy devouring assets in Latin America. In Argentina in the late 1980s, inflation shot up by as much as 5,000%. Again, this massive hyperinflation has been widely blamed on the government madly printing money. And again, the facts turn out to be quite different. Argentina had been troubled by inflation ever since 1947, when Juan Perón came to power. Perón was a populist who implemented many new programs for workers and the poor, but he did it with heavy deficit spending and taxation rather than by issuing money greenback style. What happened to the Argentine economy after Perón is detailed in a 2006 Tufts University article by Carlos Escudé, director of the Center for International Studies at Universidad del CEMA in Buenos Aires. He writes that inflation did not become a national crisis until the eighth year following Perón's death in 1974. Then the inflation rate increased sevenfold to an astonishing 206%. But this jump, says Professor Escudé, was not caused by a sudden printing of pesos. Rather, it was the result of an intentional, radical devaluation of the currency by the new government, along with a 175% increase in the price of oil. The devaluation was effected by dropping the peso's dollar peg to a fraction of its previous value. And this was done, according to insiders, with the intent of creating economic chaos. And we will look at more details about this in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.